KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all white life. Peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, a filmmaker's assistant read hundreds of scripts and homed in on the one that turned into the movie Salt. Plus, the film Inception involved planting ideas in the mind. The marketing campaign tried to do that too. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined by my co-banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. So, John, Sylvester Stallone, who'd have thunk it?
That he would be the savior of Lionsgate?
With a hit movie this past weekend.
They certainly needed one. Most of the headlines about Lionsgate lately have either been about their earnings. They lost $64 million in the last quarter, or their fight against Carl Icahn, who is trying to take the company over. And finally, they have a hit from a movie that I think everybody underestimated even a month ago.
I think it's easy to underestimate a movie like The Expendables, which stars an array of...
Has-beens, is that the word you want to use?
Has-beens, some of whom perhaps never were, I don't know. And, you know, I guess it's great. We're hearing how big the baby boom audience is and how underserved it is. And this shows that if you step up and serve the baby boomers, they may... Once in a while, I mean, they didn't do it for like whatever Rambo or Rocky he last did, but they may turn out.
Well, I think what's also interesting about this movie is that it played much younger than anybody would have imagined. And that is not only surprising, but that's what hurt Universal's Scott Pilgrim. And I think it portends that maybe this movie will – it's not going to hang in there for a while, but it's going to do a pretty good amount of business. And for Sony to come out on top with Eat, Pray, Love, that movie's going to have to play week after week after week because I think Expendables took a lot of money out of the box office.
Meanwhile, the Expendables will become available via Netflix thanks to a new deal, a billion-dollar deal that Netflix struck with Epix, which is this pay TV service, which Paramount started. Paramount got mad at Showtime and it got into a fight. And Paramount teamed up with two powerhouse partners.
Are there air quotes around powerhouse?
I think you could hear those powerhouse partners, MGM and Lionsgate. MGM, which basically is putting out, I don't know, Hot Tub Time Machine and not much else. And Lionsgate, you know, had been sort of choking it with movies like Killers, this Ashton Kutcher bomb up until they got The Expendables. But this is a big deal, not only in that it makes, you know, Epix had been this sort of a laughing stock in Hollywood that was such considered a very stupid idea. And this deal on net makes it, you know, suddenly profitable by 2011.
Well, Epix is not a big hit. It's not on the biggest cable channels. It's not on DirecTV. And Netflix is essentially saying, I think, getting your DVDs in the mail model may not last for long. And as people increasingly watch films and television on their computers, and sometimes their computers are connected to their TVs, we want to be in the business of streaming movies over the internet, regardless of where they're seen. And I think it's a very interesting model. I mean, the cable channels are now... especially the movie channels are doing a lot of original programming. HBO is programming.
And Showtime as well.
And Showtime. And I think Netflix and Epix say there is a place for movies. Now, the Netflix movies that are streamed over your computer are not going to be instantaneous to their appearance on cable television. It's going to be about 90 days after. But right now, as it stands, HBO, which runs movies from Warner Brothers, Universal, and 20th Century Fox, the movies that are on HBO are not on Netflix video service until 8 years. So 90 days versus 8 years, it seems like it's a step in the right direction.
One of the things that I find hugely confusing at this point is what is available when and where. And I think I'm not alone in that regard, like who has which properties when. But the Netflix play is clearly, you know, it's okay to wait a while if you have a really broad library, much broader than you could get if you went to the video store, for example.
And even though this could cost them $1 billion over the next 5 years, they're going to save hundreds of millions of dollars by their own estimates in postage. So in some ways, delivering movies over the internet is a lot cheaper than delivering through the mail.
And one of the partners in this Epix pay TV channel, MGM, looks like finally the drama around it. It's been dangling over the abyss of bankruptcy for a while now, with the various buyers sniffing and not really stepping up. Looks like that may be coming to an end finally.
I mean, this is an incredibly troubled company. It's got about $4 billion in debt. It still has hundreds of employees, and yet its film production, well, I'll name the four movies: Zookeeper, Red Dawn, Hot Tub Time Machine, and Cabin in the Woods. That's not a movie studio. That's a hobby. So I think if Gary Barber and Roger Birnbaum of Spyglass Entertainment, which is essentially a film finance unit, end up running MGM in some form, maybe it'll step up. Maybe it'll get back on track with James Bond. Maybe they'll get back on track with The Hobbit. But right now, something has to happen. Or
there's still a big question as to how they're actually financing the whole operation. I mean, movie studios burn money, and money is not in abundant supply right now in Hollywood.
No, and they, by their own estimates, they need to raise between $400 and $500 million. So it is not the last chapter in this long-running MGM soap opera.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
John Horner, The Los Angeles Times. It's a cliche in Hollywood that assistants are taken for granted, even brutalized by their bosses. You have your Ari Gold in HBO's Entourage, and of course, Kevin Spacey in the 1994 movie Swimming with Sharks.
What you think means nothing. What you feel means nothing. You are here for me. You are here to protect my interests and to serve my needs.
But in real life, not all Hollywood assistants are treated with contempt. Some are trusted allies who run offices, deal with finances, set meetings, and even sift through scripts and pitches. In an industry without an obvious path to success, being an assistant can be a great way to learn the business and get hold of that vital Hollywood commodity, contacts. Our first guest, Bea Cicada, is currently assisting Mark Webb, director of 500 Days of Summer, on his new movie, the Columbia Pictures project known only as the Untitled Spider-Man Reboot. Previously, Cicada was the assistant to Philip Noyce, director of Patriot Games, Clear and Present Danger, and the Angelina Jolie thriller, Salt.
You gotta walk in. A defector.
No one can sort out a nut job in the real thing faster than you.
Today, a Russian agent will travel to New York City to kill the president.
This guy's selling smoke.
Wrap it up, Ev.
The name of the agent is Evelyn Salt.
My name is Evelyn Salt.
Then you are a Russian spy.
A few years ago, Philip Noyce's agent, Steve Rabinow, sent over the script of Salt, along with a bunch of others, for Cicada to read. After 4 years of reading four or five scripts a week, Cicada knew she'd finally found the project for her boss. She talked with our executive producer, Matt Holzman, about picking that winning script out of the pile.
You know, liking films and liking scripts are two different things.
Absolutely.
How did you learn? Why does somebody assume that they're going to hire somebody and that that person is going to be able to read the text and imagine a film out of it? Because I know I read scripts. It just they don't mean anything to me. They don't translate that way.
That's a very good question. I read them as an audience member. Like, would I pay money to see the films? Because I actually go see three films every weekend. I love film. I work in film. But I'm an audience member, and I know what somebody wants to pay money to see.
Did you have a lot of scripts that started off very promising and you thought, oh, finally, after reading scripts for how many years did you
I worked for Philip for 4 years.
So after a couple of years, if you've even read 100 a year or 200 a year, you've read an awful lot of scripts, right? And did you when you opened one and you thought, wow, this seems pretty good, did you get like excited? Were you getting emotionally involved in it?
Yeah, and it was – there was one script that I read. It was the Changeling that actually Angelina Jolie also did, that I thought the script was fantastic, like from the first page. And I remember actually Philip was in Australia and I emailed him. I was like, oh, this script is really great. And he said, do you think it's for me? And I had to take a step. I was like, yeah, no, I don't think so.
What? Why?
I didn't think he will connect with the material. I just didn't think that it had all the elements that he looks for in films. Even though it was like a beautifully written script and, you know, it turned out to be a good movie. I just knew, like, when he asked me that question, I sort of, like, snapped out of my own, you know, ego of, like, oh, my God, this is the best script ever. You must do it. To, like, yeah, no, it's not for him.
So you had had some close calls. You had read The Changeling, and you recognized that it was good. But the vast majority of what you read...
This is what happened. There was a time where, I'm not kidding you, every script I read was about terrorism. And it felt to me as reading, like, they... just changed the Cold War was now so like they changed Russians and they put
right Islamic fundamentalists. Right.
And I thought to myself, like, we need to be careful about this because, you know, it's not as black and white as like you're making it feeling this like
right. What was your feeling at the time when you when the SALT where did the SALT script come from?
SALT script came from Steve Rabino, amongst another bunch of scripts. At the time, Philip was in Australia. He was working on doing Dirt Music, which is a passion project that he's doing with his producer there, Miranda. And I read it, and I thought to myself, you know, there is something here beyond the, you know, summer popcorn movie. There is something there. There's a character, and I think you should totally read it. So I email him. And
had you ever had him read other scripts that you had read? Had you ever really gotten behind any piece of work before that time?
A little bit behind Changeling until I realized that it wasn't for him.
Right.
I did push
right.
for him to read it. But there was not another script. I always, like, you know, had given him coverage or talked about a script, but nothing that I would say, you must read it yourself.
So maybe 500 or 600 scripts and 4 years in, you read this script. Were you a little excited about that?
I was excited, yeah. I was excited because I thought it's an action film, which he obviously has done really well. But there's also a character in there, which he has also done. You know, it's
right.
sort of like mixing Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger era with something like The Quiet American.
Right.
You know, like about characters.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was in Australia, and I remember sort of like checking what time it was, and I did call him and said, you might have to read this one. So.
And what did he say? He said, like, about time, Bea.
No, not really. He said, oh, well, no, he didn't want to make a big film. He was just focusing on their music, so he just wanted to make smaller movies. So
he was working on this passion project in Australia. His head was not in Hollywood
no,
at all.
No, at all. No. I mean, of course, if there was something good, he would have, you know, but so he's like, you know, I think you should read it because it's a... It might be a bigger movie, but you can still make your character.
So in a way, you really had to, you have to pitch it to him.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I did my notes, and he read it, and then I remember he called me, and he was like, this is good. And I was like, I told you so? You know, like, you never want to say that, but I was like, oh, my God, yay. So, but it was sort of bittersweet because I had already taken another job. So I was transitioning, so I was going to leave. However, I did stay in touch with him and read other drafts of it and gave my notes, even though I was at another job. I kept in touch with him and the project. And when the movie was done, I saw different cuts. So I feel involved with the movie, even though I didn't work on it. So,
you know, you have to, if you work in Hollywood, I think you have to have a sense. I think this is why people are so neurotic in Hollywood, because fate plays such a gigantic role in everything that happens.
Absolutely.
Things have to just fall in place, and you have to get a script, and you have to read it and like it and be able to get, and he has to be receptive, and all these things have to happen. And I think it's kind of magical, though, that right at the time that this thing started to happen, after 4 years of reading hundreds of scripts, you've moved on. Do you ever reflect on that and just think, what a weird world I work in?
Yes, I do, because, you know, at the time, because he was in Australia and it looked like Dirt Music was going, I was like, you know what, I can't be here for 2 years with knowing that, you know, I'm not going to be doing anything.
Right. So you decided to leave because attention was on this other passion project.
And also because we both knew that, you know, that I had been with him for 4 years, and he always says that you need to move on and sort of experience something else, and which I think that is a very wise advice.
If you're just joining us, our executive producer, Matt Holzman, is talking with Bea Cicada. As the former assistant to director Philip Noyce, she read hundreds of scripts looking for his next project. She finally found SALT, Noyce's latest film, the thriller starring Angelina Jolie.
I want to go back to this idea that, you know, Hollywood is a power place, and power is judged in many ways by if you can get a movie made or not, if you can get a television show made or not. And I don't think that people think of a script reader as being a power person, but the fact of the matter is you have an enormous amount of power.
Thank you. Can I get a T-shirt with that? you know, the thing is and that was my mistake, thinking that the film business was different. You know, here in Los Angeles, it's all about who you know, who you go to drinks with, who you have lunch with, what agents you know. And I didn't go into that game. Perhaps now, looking back, and if I could talk to my 24-year-old self, I would say, can you please go have drinks with everybody you know?
Right.
I didn't. I just chose to read and you know, and fall in love and get married. I'm sorry. But
I mean, I think at this point, do you not have – I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but it sounds like you're saying you read scripts for other people as well.
Yes. I used to read scripts for Sundance Institute.
For Sundance Institute. But I mean, a person with good judgment is highly respected. It's the other side of power.
Yes.
Talent.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you get a reputation for being somebody who can recognize quality material, and that is rare indeed. So
yeah, it is. I mean, but because I didn't play that game, then I'm not in a position of more power. However, I now thinking back, I like working with filmmakers, and I don't mind being in the shadow and not having like a big title and just going to drinks with whoever. You know, I like making movies. I like being part of it, and I like the process, and I like the results. So, yeah.
It sounds like you like what you're making and not the how it's made.
Yes.
You have a master's degree from AFI in film producing.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of two questions. One is, how helpful was that education in being able to read scripts and identify good material? And the flip side of that is, were there times when you wanted to say, you can't talk to me that way. I have a master's degree in producing from AFI.
The master's degree at AFI was not helpful to be able to determine, because it's not oriented to that. It's more of a physical production.
Nuts
things.
And bolts of producing.
Yeah. And I've always been very humble. It was more sort of like, you know, you would think, for a second you have them as like, I have a master's degree and I speak four languages and I should, and then you just realize like, so what? You know, you're doing what you want. I mean, rather be doing this than, you know.
Right.
So it was, it was never, I know there are a lot of people like that. And I was always surprised of seeing people that were younger than me. They were like, I have a degree in producing from NYU. I should be running Paramount. It's like, perhaps you shouldn't, you know.
So tell me about what your job is now.
Right now, I'm working with Mark Webb, who directed 500 Days of Summer on Spider-Man.
That must be very exciting. That's a huge project.
Yeah, that's why I when the opportunity came, I was very happy at my other job. I was just like, this is a great mixture of things, like working with a filmmaker directly and working in a huge studio movie. It's an experience that I'm going to learn so much, and I am. So,
are you still reading scripts?
I am. Yeah, I still do it. Yeah, I like reading scripts for people. And
have you seen anything that's exciting?
I actually read one, and I optioned it, which was sort of like,
wow,
why not do that? So yeah.
So we'll have you back on the show when you're producing your script.
Please do. Hopefully, yes.
Beatriz Siqueira was director Philip Noyce's assistant for 4 years. She read many, many scripts before coming across Salt, his latest film. She's currently working with Mark Webb, the director of 500 Days of Summer, whose new film, which will be coming out sometime next year, you think?
July 3rd, 2012.
There you go, is Spider-Man. Bea, thanks for coming down.
Thank you so much.
If you're an assistant, we'd love to hear about your life in the business. Just go to the comment page for today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness. Coming up after a short break, marketing the top secret original movie, Inception. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and kcrw.com. the Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The Christopher Nolan psychological thriller Inception is a huge hit at the box office, grossing close to $500 million worldwide and counting.
There's one thing you should know about me. I specialize in a very specific type of security. Subconscious security.
You're talking about dreams.
Certainly with The Dark Knight and his recent past, it's hardly surprising that Nolan knows how to make a hit movie. What is surprising is that this is an original story, almost unheard of in today's Hollywood. Most blockbusters, as you know, are based on comic book characters or their remakes or sequels, which gives studios a hook for marketing them. For Inception, Warner Brothers capitalized on Nolan's fame as the director of Dark Knight, and having Leo DiCaprio in the lead certainly didn't hurt. But Inception is hardly based on a pre-sold idea, and it doesn't exactly have what you'd call a high-concept plot that can be summarized in a sentence. And director Christopher Nolan and his producing team wanted to keep the movie mysterious. Secrecy was key. Michael Tritter, Senior Vice President of Interactive Marketing for Warner Brothers, told us how the studio sold the public on the idea of Inception and made the film an event.
First, you start by reading the script in their offices, never having an electronic copy of anything.
Oh, they didn't print out the copies.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically there's like a copy over at his office and, I don't know, maybe a couple more someplace else. But, I mean, everything's very compartmentalized. It was just sort of anybody working directly on it would go read it over there. You know, obviously it was an incredibly interesting read. And trying to picture it as it's happening was kind of amazing. But then we kind of went...
Well, let me just ask before you go on. I mean, did you read it and go, what?
No, I just had to really pay attention.
Okay.
It was also just, I mean, you were reading it knowing that he could do it.
Okay. You know, so you read it, you say, now I have to sell it.
So basically what you have is you have this movie which is going to have a kind of a pretty big built-in fan base that you have to engage on some level, but you also have a movie that you're trying to keep very... secret. You know, Chris really likes people to see his movies in the theater and not see it all beforehand. So everything that you do to market that is, you know, at least early on, is with an eye to feeding the interest of fans while really preserving that experience. I mean, later on when you have to go bigger and broader, you're going to have to start showing more and more of the movie. But we knew that we weren't just going to wait until a few months before the movie to do this, because obviously there's a huge expectation following up from The Dark Knight. So out of this idea of sort of keeping things secret but feeding this fan interest, we had the idea for a long-term viral game, which would be this maze game. The whole idea is that for this interested fan base there, you'd be teaching people about the movie without actually telling them the plot.
Now, not being the fangirl that I perhaps should be, I didn't play this game,
sure.
But when you looked at it, was there anything that was about dreaming, or was it just it's a maze game?
It was done on different levels. We actually started early on. I mean, the other thing that the studio did is we had an announcement trailer out very early, which was sort of maybe cryptic is the word, but just a teaser trailer, really, about 11 months before the film was in August of last year. We started releasing some cryptic stuff online. We put out just a spinning top that you could control on the website, and that was all that was there for a little while. And then eventually when the second trailer came out, there was actually a simple overhead maze game that you would draw it, and then when you made your way through that game, we released the first asset, which was the teaser poster. So the second phase of that started to build in Facebook stuff, and you could actually pull other people's things out of their mazes that they created, which was called extraction. The third phase of it let you actually alter the mazes and create different versions of them, which was creation, or like architecture, like in the film. And then the final phase of it was actually letting you put things inside of other people's mazes, which was Inception. So if you actually look back on it, you've kind of given people the rules of the film all within this game. Also, it was basically this parallel marketing path that we created over that time that then fed back and forth between the mainstream stuff. We would release assets through the game. We would put hints to other things within the game. The third trailer we placed online within a theater inside the city of the game. So it actually kind of created this foundation for us to work with.
I mean, it's just much harder in a way. The idea of an original film in summer seems so quaint, right? But so do you just have to, is it feel so different? You know, with Dark Knight, we knew it was about Batman. So it wasn't so difficult to say, this is the premise, the concept that we want you to be engaged with.
Luckily, we had so much great stuff that was developed in theater placements and television placements that we were able to make use of. So the interactive part of it was able to draft off that incredibly well.
I mean, what's more important, the stuff on the bigger, broader, or the fan person stuff?
That's a really good question. I think there's not one without the other. There's a level of engagement that a certain amount of the audience is going to expect and that you really want to engage with. And at the same time, I think you would never not have the big broad mainstream part of it, too.
In the stuff that you were doing in the early going, I think it was early, correct me if I'm wrong, that Christopher Nolan did there was a comic book prequel.
The comic actually came out later in the campaign. That was released opening week, and again, that was something that helped introduce some of the ideas of the film. We placed the first part of it on Leonardo DiCaprio's site, because there was a whole audience there that we wanted to make sure was fully engaged. And then the next day we placed the entire thing on Yahoo. And so obviously speaking very directly to a comic book crowd, but also to a very, very mainstream movie-going crowd that goes to Yahoo movies.
Right. And I assume that got a fair bit of attention. That
it did, absolutely.
And then you had a Facebook page at some point?
Yeah, I mean, we have Facebook pages for all of our films. And what that's actually been especially helpful for as well is people who saw the movie and liked it and have gone back even after the film to then sign up on this page or to say they've liked it and to kind of continue the conversation, which is something, you know, particularly unique about the film, I think, that obviously it engenders an incredible amount of conversation. And we're able to sort of keep feeding that and let people keep talking about it on this page. And when we find articles that people write, which we think are particularly interesting, theories about the film, that we'll post up there and then let people kind of engage and debate about it there as well.
So the film was meant to be secret. Did that hamper you, or was it just part of the game of selling
it? It's just sort of part of the game. I mean, I guess it feels like espionage a lot of the time, but it's not actually that unusual with films when we try to keep stuff pretty secret. It's just even more so with Chris. And also, it's to a good end. It's not being secret for the sake of it. It truly does make the film going experience of seeing this film and knowing something about it, but not everything about it, really kind of special.
So at what point do you know it's working?
There's two phases. We know it's working beforehand. We know it really worked after it comes out as well. Because like beforehand, when you see people picking everything apart, we put a handwritten note inside this viral game that we had created mentioning someone in the military. And if you search for that person's name on YouTube, you actually found a video which was titled Christopher Nolan Research Footage, which looked as if it were leaked. And it was actually Chris himself, he actually participated in this, which is a big win, interviewing dream researchers, supposedly as research for the film. And two of them were real, and one of them was not. And one of them was an actress. So basically, we kept it going. It's completely real information up until the end. There was a slight bit of stuff that she mentioned about the military's involvement in something called dream sharing. And everything else about it was true, except for this one false thing. And people immediately finding out who was the real researcher, what she was talking about was real, what was not. Everybody completely picking up on every kind of little clue that's dropped.
Right.
That's a great sign to us. And also knowing after the fact to see people writing these long, long think pieces about it is like incredibly satisfying as well. It's been trending on Twitter since it came out, basically. That's when you know it's really entered the cultural conversation as well.
So the movie, in a way, is like a marketer's dream, right? You get to plant ideas in people's minds. Did that ever occur to you guys? Did you say, we're going to do some inception?
We basically just implanted the idea of everyone that the movie was going to be number one and everyone had to go see it twice. Yeah, the lingo of the movie definitely kind of made it into like all of our conversations as we were working on it, no doubt.
Michael Tritter is Senior Vice President for Interactive Marketing for Warner Brothers. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Matt Holzman is our executive producer. The theme music mashup was designed by beat architect Jason Grohman. To leave a comment about today's show, email us at thebusiness@kcrw.org or go to kcrw.com/thebusiness, where you can also stream and podcast the show and check out past episodes. And you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.